Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is David Black. My guest today is Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, Professor Emeritus of Medicine at the University of Massachusetts. He created the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program, well known as MBSR. He's the author of many leading mindfulness meditation books, including Full Catastrophe Living, which offers the key ingredients for the MBSR program. And that book is now published in 10 languages. Hundreds of medical centers and clinics now use the MBSR model as part of their treatment approach. And this is a continuation. We had two episodes previously, and this is part three of a three-part series about John's development of MBSR, his contributions to defining participatory medicine, and his research efforts on testing MBSR to uncover its utility for pain, anxiety, and other forms of human suffering. Welcome, Dr. Kabat-Zinn. It's wonderful to have you again. I'm excited to continue our conversation. So
thanks,
what
David.
I titled
it's
that,
wonderful and to
I,
be here.
It's always great to have you. And I titled it, and I don't know if you like that or not, on the origins of mindfulness research, because I was really wanting to examine the trajectory of where a field can originate and then all of the impacts it can have as it moves along over time. And now we're talking really about 50 years.
Yeah.
And that's a life's work, right? You've put in so much effort and stayed focused. And I'm thinking currently, like, how do you stay focused decade after decade? And in our conversations, we had already addressed your pain work and your work on examining effects of MBSR and anxiety. So I would like to move forward in our conversation. Is there any book end that you wanted to address on those earlier studies, the pain studies, the anxiety studies? Is there any summary point at that point in your career?
I guess the only summary point would be that from the perspective of the origins of mindfulness, since mindfulness is not something I made up, but it's the, you know, thousands of years of tradition, and then with its most highest or most refined articulation within the sort of the Buddhist tradition. But if one understands anything about the Buddhist tradition, one understands that it's really about the nature of mind. So it doesn't have so much to do with whether you're a Buddhist or not, but more whether you're a human being or not. And so from that point of view, the nature of suffering and the potential to liberate oneself, if you will, from certain kinds of suffering is absolutely central. And what those early years of MBSR research were basically demonstrating is that people who were suffering with a wide range of different kinds of medical disorders and diagnoses that were not getting full satisfaction within the mainstream healthcare system would respond to training, fairly rigorous training in mindfulness meditation, without the sort of source code of the Buddhism, so to speak, but in its more universal articulation, in ways that would actually continue the work of the clinical medicine beyond where drugs and surgery were going to be of any help. In other words, that there is a way in which we can draw on profound interior resources that are really our birthright, that are part and parcel of simply being human, but that we often don't get any schooling in how to recognize, never mind access, in the ongoing unfolding of our lives. So MBSR was basically meant to be an intensive intervention over 8 weeks that would teach people how to actually mobilize their own interior resources through attention and awareness for ongoing learning and engagement with one's own challenges, whether they be physical challenges in terms of pain and discomfort in the body or in the mind, and stress and so forth. And then out of that learning process over 8 weeks with a group of 30 or 40 other people in the class, so it's not just individual therapy or anything like that, but more self-education in, you know, in a kind of community. Out of that learning by coming up against your own moment by moment experience and seeing what your mind does with that, what your body does with that, so forth. And then hearing what other people's minds and bodies do with it, because it's a class, not just in one individual. A certain kind of growing happens. It's inevitable. You grow a bigger view of yourself, of other people, of what's possible. And out of that growing, inevitably, a certain kind of healing comes about. And I define healing as coming to terms with things as they are. So it's not like fixing, it's not curing, it's not getting rid of your pain, but in some sense, putting out the welcome mat out for the full spectrum of the experiencing of what we call pain, and then understanding how it relates to suffering. And as they say, I mean, pain is, you know, inevitable, but the suffering element is something that we may have a lot more agency around mitigating, if not dissolving completely, than we think. And then out of that healing, that coming to terms with things as they are, what unfolds is inevitably transformation, that one becomes larger than the narratives of who we think we are, especially if you self-define as a chronic pain patient or as a person with this particular disease or that particular disease or this particular stress or that particular history. And you begin to realize that being human is a hell of a mystery, and the arc of one's life is not finished until one draws one's last breath. And being willing to commit to, in some sense, inhabiting our moments as opposed to blasting through them to always be getting to better idealized moments is a potential new way to be in wise relationship with one's life, and therefore with one's health and potential to live across the lifespan as robust and healthy a life as is possible, whether we're talking about the life of the body or the life of the mind, or for that matter, the life of our intersection with other people in community.
So that's, I totally get your point. And suffering can come in many forms and in many types. And as we talked about in previous episodes, didn't necessarily matter which condition, it was about treating and healing the suffering by getting people to participate more fully in their lives.
And that was a radical perspective in medicine in 1979, that we would take people with a vast range of different medical diagnoses and even some psychiatric diagnoses associated with anxiety and depression, and put everybody in the same room. I mean, that's the exact opposite of the magic bullet scientific medicine. We have to diagnose exactly what's wrong and then treat it specifically with, the antidote for whatever the root cause or the basic disruption of mechanism is in the diagnosis. But we're saying, well, no, we're going to take people with a vast range of different diagnoses and medical histories and put them all together in the same room and focus on what's right with them rather than what's wrong with them. And one of the things that we notice, and I'm saying this, of course, completely tongue in cheek, is that everybody who comes into that room, whether they walk into the room, whether on occasion were brought in on a stretcher or on crutches or whatever, that everybody who showed up in the MBSR classroom showed up in a body. And every single one of those people, I won't say bodies, was breathing. And so those are really wonderful places to start with an awareness of the life in the body, so to speak, that's more fundamental than the pain in the body or the diagnosis that you come with and so forth. Because as we like to say to people to this very day, no matter, there's more right with you than wrong with you, no matter what's wrong with you. And what MBSR is designed to do is pour energy in the form of attention and the awareness that arises out of attending in that way. Pour energy into what's right with you, let the rest of the healthcare system take care of quote unquote what's wrong with you, and see what happens over the arc of 8 weeks. And what we saw happen was you could almost hear the symptoms dropping, major reductions in pain and anxiety and depression and all sorts of complaints. And this was then a kind of revelation to people that they could participate in their own health and well-being by engaging to whatever degree possible in this very disciplined attending to inner and outer experience through the cultivation of awareness.
In your evolution of that work as a scientist in the late 1990s, you started transitioning your attention to some skin disorders, which I thought was a really interesting approach. You have some work published in Psychosomatic Medicine. With that same process in mind of healing, participation in one's care, and also having medical treatments. So here you looked at using MBSR as an intervention to see if you can aid psoriasis clearing. And this was simultaneous with them getting a mainstream treatment, which is phototherapy. What was your lens as a scientist at that point? You're shifting attention. You're looking at this really interesting opportunity. Is there a biological correlation with a psychological phenomenon? Really interesting and innovative for the time. So where were you at? Could you take us back 1990s? Where do you see yourself as a scientist?
Yeah, I actually started in the early 80s or the mid 1980s when I happened to go on a Department of Medicine faculty retreat for the day. And I had lunch with the head of dermatology, the chief of dermatology. And he, you know, was asking me about the stress reduction clinic because it was fairly new in those days. And of course, he was saying, oh boy, my psoriasis patients, my phototherapy patients, I'd never heard of the term phototherapy, they're so stressed. Do you think you could help them be less stressed while they're undergoing phototherapy? And I said, well, why don't you first just tell me what phototherapy is? And he said, well, people with the skin disease psoriasis can actually benefit symptomatically. It's not a cure for the disease, but they benefit systematically if they stand in a phototherapy light box, which has long, like 6 foot long ultraviolet light bulbs, and it's a kind of circular container, and you get in there basically naked, but with sort of protection over your eyes and particularly sensitive regions of the body. And then you kind of like baked in a rotisserie oven for extended periods of time, starting for very short periods of time, but you build up. And it's like being on the beach under a blazing hot sun. And the ultraviolet light of particular wavelengths knocks out the rapidly growing cells in the epidermis and the skin clears. Now, again, it's not a cure. You have to come back for another round of phototherapy sessions, maybe in 6 months or whatever, but it can actually help people at least symptomatically have clear skin. And when he was telling me that over lunch, light bulbs were going off in my head, because I was thinking, well, like, you know, it's very nice to help reduce people's stress under these obviously very stressed conditions. Who would want to be baked naked in a, you know, toaster oven? But what I saw immediately was this would be an incredible study design for asking the question, the fundamental question, can the mind actually influence a healing process that you could see and photograph and document in really objective ways? Because if you randomize people between, they just get the light treatment, the phototherapy treatment by itself, and you measure the kinetics of skin clearing, and you have another group, randomized group, and they, while they're in the light box, they're practicing standing meditation, cultivating mindfulness in a standing position, or you could say adapted to standing naked in a light box, getting irradiated with ultraviolet light, which is a form of meditation that you can bring awareness to, then maybe their skin would respond faster if you were bringing the mental practice together with the more conventional light therapy. And so he was game for actually trying it on a pilot level. We took a bunch of patients and randomized them between they either get the light phototherapy by itself, or they get me with a guided meditation that I designed for people standing and being irradiated in a light booth, naked with their eyes and other parts of their body shielded, and see what would happen. And what happened in this pilot project, that we noticed that the people who were getting the guided meditation while they were in the light box, their skin was clearing way before the people who were just getting the treatment by itself. So that said, okay, now we should really have a more robust study where we randomize people and we have more people in the study. So we did that and published, that's the paper you're referring to in Psychosomatic Medicine. And it demonstrated that the people in the light box who were meditating were healing at a rate that approximated 4 times the rate of the people who were just getting the light treatment by itself. So that was like, I don't mean this to suggest that this is the end of the whole question of can the mind influence a healing process, but it was certainly very interesting preliminary evidence that something that people were doing inside the light box, and there's not much you can do inside a light box when you have your eyes shielded and you're standing there naked being irradiated by, you know, ultraviolet light. There's not much you can actually do, but you can follow these audio guided meditation instructions. And those people were, their skin was healing 4 times as fast. So my hope at the time, this is now published in the late 1990s, that was that that would like light a fire under dermatologists everywhere to actually continue that and actually try to replicate it and then look at the mechanisms of action that might potentially be functioning there that might have to do with various growth factors, dermatological growth factors and so forth that not only are related to psoriasis, but are actually related to basal cell carcinoma. So there's some interesting intersections between basal cell carcinoma and psoriasis, although psoriasis is not a cancerous uncontrolled cell proliferation, but it is an uncontrolled cell proliferation. So it didn't, I think, ever fully develop the way I hoped it had, but those studies are sitting in the literature. And at some point, maybe someone will come along and say, holy cow, we need to do this now, 25, 30 years later, at a level that would really be adequate to the potential result of seeing that what the mind does can influence a healing process, you know, at the level of skin metabolism.
And there may be a few out, just a handful, and I'm going to send those to you, see what you think on the topic, dermatologists and skin clearing. And a couple of other things that you described that I think are really important.
Did they ever replicate it? Do you know?
Not fully replicated, but akin to, okay, to this glad thinking to about that. Skin clearing. So I'll send those to you. A couple of things that you did, you know, adapting of a program for use for a specific setting.
Yeah, so there wasn't, just to be clear, because of what you said at the beginning, it wasn't MBSR. It was just the mindfulness practice itself. Not MBSR is a group intervention that goes over weeks and weeks with a lot of people with different medical diagnoses. So this was more like just the bare meditation practice itself in the light box.
So it's, yeah, an audio guided meditation. You adapted this for use in the light box. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because, especially post COVID-19 world, we are delivering a lot of audio programs remotely. So this has kind of been in some degree where the scientific field has headed. I don't know, just by chance, given what had happened. And we had to deliver this quite a bit, but you were already doing this. So not necessarily having to give an entire structured group-based program, but perhaps the benefit of even just participating in a mindfulness program as you were receiving treatment. So, and we've used a similar model. So that might tell us something about how you can use this in degrees in various treatment settings and with adaptation. A colleague and I at our university used this before occupational therapy of the wrists, where patients thought it was very uncomfortable and it brought on a lot of anxiety to be mobile with their wrists after injury. We used it in a different trial during active chemotherapy. There's a lot of ways in which the way you adapted this and gave people ideas that, oh, there's something where a patient, even though if it's brief, can participate in that healing art that you mentioned in real-time mainstream treatment. So they don't even need to be separated in time and space. It can actually happen in a simultaneous manner, which I think you made a lot of people realize with this study. It's like, oh, just you can bridge them with true integration in the moment and in the medical setting.
So in fact, a lot of psoriasis patients, I mean, those guided meditations are available on the web. You can find them, and you don't necessarily need the light box. You know, there've been people, the reason I started this whole thing was I had someone before I started the phototherapy study. I had a woman in my class who had psoriasis, and I'd never had a woman who had had psoriasis in my class, or a person who had psoriasis in my class before. And she said that around week four of the program, her psoriasis started to get better. So that was one more sort of indicator that maybe you don't even need the light, the phototherapy, that the mind could actually influence the unfolding of the symptomatology of the disease. And of course, these are big open questions and they have huge implications. It also in terms of like, healthcare costs, because if you don't need multiple phototherapy treatments where you have to come to the hospital and it takes a long time to actually get undressed and get ready to have the treatment, and then you have to get back dressed and then you have to get it to the parking lot. And then, you know, this is like a burden on people. But what if you could practice in your own home and get 40, 50, 80, 100% of the benefit? We just don't know, but that's where this notion of participating as a patient in the trajectory of your own health and well-being across the lifespan becomes really important. That maybe we can tap into interior resources that will actually amplify whatever treatments we are being prescribed, whether they're on the surgical side or whether on the medical treatment side, and therefore optimize the potential for healing across the lifespan.
And I agree. And as with another case study, a friend who has psoriasis, it seems to be a similar cycle of events. The first being things in my life are uncontrollable. I am starting to get outbreaks. My psoriasis is getting really bad. Getting really red and itchy. It's frustrating me. I'm really mad. I can't believe I have this happening. And then I'm going to go get treatment. I'm going to go put the lotions on. And then when he starts to participate, he starts just feeling better. And it's probably having something to do with the medicine. And then I see him saying, I need to go take care of myself. And then you see the whole healing process happen again. And I want to link that to what you said. It's so common for humans and us to always be in this mode of falling into the damage, realizing the damage is occurring, waking up to the damage. And perhaps what you're saying is if we go more preventative on this process, maybe through routine practice, we can alleviate some of that additional suffering where
absolutely.
You don't have to show
if
it.
You want to optimize, if you want to optimize health and well-being, there are certain dimensions that nurture health across the lifespan that are now axiomatic. I mean, 50 years ago, it was an open question whether lifestyle had anything to do with disease, whether it was heart disease, cancer, or anything else. But now it's pretty obvious, and there's a lot of compelling evidence that lifestyle has a lot to do with heart disease, what you eat, and how much stress you're under, and all sorts of other diagnoses as well. So the more you can, in some sense, take care of the apparatus, so to speak, the full dimensionality of your being. So not just your body, but also your mind, and not just your mind in the sense of thoughts and emotions, but also in terms of our relationship to the outside world, to our love for other people, to the stress of work and so forth, to the beauty of nature. And you can hold all of that in awareness in a kind of disciplined and systematic way, which is what meditation is all about. Now the evidence is that feeds back not just at the level of the brain and the nervous system and transforms things through neuroplastic change and driving of functional connectivity so that different neurons in different parts of the brain will speak to each other, but also in terms of the epigenome, that it actually upregulates and downregulates scores, if not hundreds, of enzymatic practices and genes that control them, that actually promote well-being and that reduce what's now thought to be at the root of many, many chronic diseases, and that is inflammatory processes. And these are all genetically related in that that can be influenced epigenetically by lifestyles of various kinds. And so, yeah, I mean, the more we learn to actually live our lives as if they really mattered and capture every single moment, because it's the only moment we ever really are alive in. And the more we learn to inhabit awareness in a way that, in some sense, establishes calmness and equanimity as our kind of a default mode, and not rather than anxiety and incredible chronic stress levels in the mind, always worrying about what hasn't happened yet, the future, or perseverating around the past, which is over, but that's what most of us do all the time, that actually that would have profound effects on all of the various biological mechanisms that result in well-being. And that if one engaged in this across the lifespan and learned it in kindergarten, rather than in an MBSR class in your 40s and 50s after a heart attack, or a chronic pain condition that's really made it impossible for you to do the work that you love, that really makes a huge amount of sense and is really, as we've spoken about in other podcasts, highlights the public health dimension of MBSR, that it actually has the potential to move the bell curve of the entire society towards greater levels of kind of generic health and well-being. And that we can actually explore the science of how this works and see what its effects are on not just longevity, but disease burden of chronic ailments across the lifespan. And that would huge effects on medical costs, on healthcare costs in the United States, which is a gigantic part of the federal budget.
And this seems related to the term you brought up in the Journal of the European Academy of Dermatology. This is when you've used this term participatory medicine and the patient's role in engaging in their own health and healing. And I just remember reading, I went back to read this commentary again, and you were pointing out that psoriasis study. And I like this link that you made, because you're using this term participatory medicine. And then when you finish out this commentary, you're talking about it's just good medicine. Yeah. We're not pointing to anything super special here. We're just saying there are ways to engage the patient. There are ways, as you're saying, to basically invest in yourself alongside the treatments that are necessary.
Yeah.
What was your thinking at the time? Yeah, this is 2000.
Part of it is a huge benefit for the physicians. Mm-hmm. Because if we, the patients, are taking responsibility for our own well-being, then our relationship with our doctors is going to be very, very different. And we would be actually in some sense, collaborators in maintaining health and well-being, as opposed to an auto mechanics model of medicine where you just don't pay any attention to your apparatus until it breaks down, and then you drive it into a garage and want to have all your organ systems replaced and just be fixed. So there's a big difference between fixing or curing and healing. And the more people do participate across the lifespan in taking care of what we can take care of, which is, of course, diet, exercise, sleep, the usual kinds of things that everybody says, and they call it lifestyle. But the thing that was most missing in the old days, and I hope this is somewhat different now, is being present in the only moment ever get, and exercising that muscle so that it, in some sense, does become our default mode. And that, I would say, is a fundamental element of health. And then you can be healthy even if you're a day away from dying. Okay, that it's like, okay, how are we going to be in relationship to this moment? Because no one solved the problem yet, although I know lots of labs are working on it, of the fact of mortality, that, you know, we're all sooner or later not going to be here. But the question is, while we're here, can we actually tilt things in the direction of optimal health across the lifespan and then die quickly without costing the system a whole lot of money, which very often now, you know, the last couple of years of life wind up costing the healthcare system just enormous amounts of money. And there may be a way in which the more we participate in our youth and middle age and across the lifespan into the elder years, that we're taking care of what we can take care of, that will reduce healthcare costs across the globe. And of course, the psoriasis study is also a health, a cost-effectiveness study, because if you need fewer treatments to reach skin clearing, well, not only does that, you know, sort of reduce your exposure to the ultraviolet light, which is itself has the risk of causing skin cancer, ironically, but it also reduced the cost because you need fewer treatments, which is good for the health care. So again, from a participatory point of view, it's almost a no-brainer. And as I understand it now, participatory medicine is one of the four P's of good medicine that the NIH is promulgating. So what started out as kind of like maybe an obscure paper in a European journal about participatory medicine has somehow, with, of course, a lot of other participants, not merely that paper, but a lot of work, has actually led to a policy change or even a kind of deeper sort of conceptual change about what is really required to stress for the well-being of the nation.
And so there is this piece to it that for some of us, it's hard to participate in better health. Have you ever run across that challenge? Because, you know, it keeps popping up in my mind is if I'm teaching a class and I could do everything I can to encourage participation, to try to prepare people for participation. And sometimes I feel like I'm banging my head against the wall, and it's some folks that sometimes don't want to participate. Yeah. Is there a special ingredient to encourage participation in this manner?
Yeah, I think there is. It's not like you'll ever get everybody, because people can only be who they are. And so, you know, a lot of people might listen to what you say, but they're not hearing what you say, or they're not getting it because they just don't, at that moment in time, at least have the framework for getting it. Of course, there are motivating factors that do wake people up, like a heart attack. A lot of cardiac patients will say that my heart attack didn't kill me, but in that sense, it was a blessing because it really woke me up to the preciousness of the present moment. And I was always living for the future or living in the past. So there's that. But I really feel like you got to make it interesting for people. One of the elements of MBSR is that it's a group, and it's a class, but it's a group of patients, and they don't all have the same diagnosis. This was another thing that was like really an outlier, because ordinarily in medicine, you'd put all cardiac patients together, you'd put all chronic low back pain patients together, not even mix them up with headache patients, but we mixed everybody up together. And as I say, focus on what's right with you rather than what's wrong with you. But looking around the room with 30 people in the room, and you hear people's stories of what they are carrying, what they're dealing with, which is the root meaning of the word to suffer, means to carry. So you're carrying a diagnosis of like chronic low back pain. And you hear the story of it, or you see somebody who's paralyzed or who's, you know, and all of a sudden you realize, and people will say this, wow, I'm not sure I even belong in this room because I don't have enough suffering. I don't have enough pain to belong in this room, because you see the size of the cloth when it comes to human suffering, that it comes in all shapes and forms and sizes. And then you begin to realize, maybe I will stick with what I've got and see if I can work with that. And I will also be inspired by all these other amazing people who are reporting that they're actually doing better than they were before, and attributing it to the meditation practice. So everybody's teaching each other. It looks like there's one instructor in the room, and there is, but in reality, we're all learning from each other. And I like to say, just in terms of MBSR teachers, that we should probably, rather than being paid by the participants in the room through their health insurance, so that's how people earn a living if they're MBSR teachers, we should be paying the people in our classes, because we're learning far more from them about the nature of the mind and the nature of reality and the nature of stress and pain and suffering than they're learning from us, no matter how much they're learning from us.
Yeah, it seemed the key from what you're saying seems to be feedback. And that's what the social environment allows us to say, like, where do we stand? And then finding value and importance in our lives because of that.
Totally.
And that's, you know, with group, as we lose, and I'm using some examples of individuals who've told me that they're going to get in the MBSR, they went through the program, and they come back and said, it was such an important thing for me in my life, but I kind of fell off and now I'm doing other things and I want that back. And I, whatever that was, and I'm just, oh, it was you. I mean, you were doing all of those wonderful things. Like,
I
that
hasn't left.
Yeah. You basically just want yourself back, and you want time, and you want to be at peace with yourself. Yeah. So I definitely see your point and the importance of feedback and having a community, because it is the only thing that can offer that feedback. And it seems like the community is the teachers who can help guide on troublesome problems, the community of people also suffering as we all do in their dynamic ways, and seeing how we can orient towards stronger values and going deeper in our lives, all seems to be a motivating feature.
True.
What you see.
And then we emphasize at the end of the program that in reality, life is the meditation practice. It's not just the 45 minutes that you're doing the body scan or a 30-minute sitting meditation practice or walking meditation, that every moment of our lives is an opportunity to be fully present and to inhabit the space of our own awareness with even awareness of how reactive we are under stressful conditions and so forth, because it's the awareness that actually modulates the reactivity and the stress, so that you don't have to fix everything or make the stress go away or make your pain go away. But when exactly you do the paradoxical opposite, is you put out the welcome mat for what's already here. And then you hold it in awareness. You realize you don't have to be worried about it in the same way. If you have anxiety, your awareness of anxiety is not anxious. If you have pain in some region of your body, your awareness of the pain actually can hold those sensations and even the emotions and thoughts around it without getting caught in the suffering of it. So it's liberating moment by moment by moment. Therefore, you can be mindful with your children. You can be mindful with your spouse or partner. You can be mindful walking down the street. Now, of course, that means you have to be mindful of the impulse to check your phone 50, you know, 600 times a day or 300 times a day, which is what people are doing, is they're constantly looking for something more interesting than the present moment. Through our five senses or eight senses or how many senses you want to attribute to us. But the digital addiction and the attention distraction economy, so to speak, is actually in the past 30 or 40 years is pulling us even further away from the analog expression of our lives. And that has an enormous amount to do with not just our physical health and well-being, but our mental and social health and well-being.
Yeah, the environment is giving us a lot more opportunity to be mindless, that is for sure.
Distracted, exactly. Yeah. Perpetually distracted.
Yes, and in a writer and thinker's career, I think there are moments when you have the chance to really clarify some points. And I bring this up because I want to tell you one of my favorite works of yours. There's so many to look at, but is this 23 publication in clinical psychology, mindfulness-based interventions in context, past, present, and future. And there's these moments that are like milestones to look back. And I don't know if it was impactful for you. What was the experience of writing this? It's cited almost 10,000 times. It's my favorite work of yours to reference when I'm talking about the definition of mindfulness, the way you operationalize it. In the context of MBSR, it's almost taking full catastrophe living, you know, summarizing it, clarifying it, and pinpointing things that different fields and researchers need. What was that for you? Was it the same experience for you? Am I reading my personal take and applying it, projecting it?
No, it's helpful for me to hear that. I wrote that paper to kind of clarify a lot of different elements about MBSR so that it didn't get denatured into one more cognitive behavioral intervention that could be misunderstood as an algorithm for achieving a certain kind of objective, whether it's stress reduction or anxiety reduction or pain reduction or depression reduction, that all those can happen, but they can't happen if you don't understand the mindfulness piece. And so I was writing it for a professional audience that consists a lot of therapists and clinicians and scientists, but in particular therapists, who often have this kind of culture where, okay, here's an intervention. I'm going to take a weekend workshop, learn what they do in MBSR, and then I will do it with or on my patients. And that's not possible with MBSR. You have to have your own meditation practice. And really, I would say it needs to incubate in your life for 5 years or 10 years before you'd be remotely capable of actually teaching what MBSR truly is. So I was writing not just that paper, but a whole bunch of papers as kind of like a way of placing the goalposts very, very emphatically in a place that emphasizes that mindfulness has a multi-thousand year history. It's not some kind of device that Jon Kabat-Zinn made up in 1979, but it draws on deep wisdom traditions that require a certain kind of giving oneself over to attending to experience in very rigorous ways, very disciplined ways, for longer than your mind is going to want to pay attention. And then when you engage in that over days, weeks, months, and years, it changes you. And as it changes you, then you develop the capacity to bring it out of other people in a way that is not reductionistic or turning mindfulness into a technique or an algorithm, but actually emphasizing it as a way, and I often say with a capital W, a way of being. And if you want more of an explanation, a way of being in relationship to our moments and the actuality of life unfolding. And there's a kind of structure to it, but it can't be taught or in effectively in a kind of reductionistic way. It has to be invited in a way that allows you and allows life to become the teacher. Life is really the mindfulness teacher, and your body is the mindfulness teacher, and your breath and your thoughts and emotions and the dark holes that we fall into in terms of depression, that it's all part of the curriculum. And that when we associate it that way, when we can approach it in that way, then it becomes literally and figuratively liberative. It liberates us from habitual patterns of behavior that very often stem from childhood and that very often propel us into old age and often into our graves. And I like the quote from Thoreau in that regard, because he said of his time at Walden, which was something of a meditative retreat in his own way, and he was very influenced by Asian meditation traditions, by the way, and he spoke about them in Walden. He said, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what they had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I hadn't lived." Okay, so that's easy to do, is to kind of go right up into your grave on autopilot and then realize, oh my God, I got the whole script wrong. I thought it was about, you know, this, that, or the other thing. And no, it's about, are you alive in this moment? And then what? How does your love, how does your passion, how does your deep caring for life itself in whatever unique ways it expresses in you, how does that manifest in ways that feed what most needs feeding in your heart in the present moment? And then mindfulness and programs like MBSR or MBCT or MBRP or MBCP, I mean, all really wonderful programs, they all become different doors into the same room. And the room is the room of the human heart. And what I like to say is that it's actually a love affair with reality. And most of the time we create these dream realities that are not true enough. And very often they're very negative narratives about how inadequate I am, or what's wrong with me, or something like that, or what's wrong with the world, and we disempower ourselves. So that paper, that 2003 paper, was meant to, in some sense, be a big container for people to actually begin to see the import of the discipline of mindfulness as a meditative practice, and not merely as some kind of popular therapy.
And I felt it that way. So of your many works, you've published across the board, and mindfulness meditation has been the core element. From your perspective, what was your favorite project?
The one I'm doing now. It's always the one I'm doing now. I mean, and it's always really one project. I mean, it's different doors, but it's always the same room. So the doors, of course, will have their own unique features. I just got off a 3-hour call with MBSR teachers in Ukraine. And we had a very, very profound conversation. And it went way beyond what I thought it might go beyond. Because when you don't fall into dualisms, even when bombs are raining down on your society and it's being destroyed or severely challenged, then you tap into something that recognizes that even Ukraine, excuse me, even Ukraine is not an isolated case. It's an example of how the human mind is behind enormous amounts of suffering, greed, hatred, and delusion, and that it has no ethic, no end of ways to cause suffering in other people if you abandon your own humanity in a certain way. And so this is a key moment on the planet. Talk about medicine. We need to do medicine on the whole planet because, you know, it's not just Ukraine. I mean, we did it in Vietnam, in the United States, and then we did it in Iraq, and then we did it in Afghanistan. And all these could be really failures that cost the lives of millions of people that didn't have to happen. And then other countries like the Russia doing it that way. I mean, the Nazi Germany. I mean, we have a history of this kind of killing fields, like in Cambodia, just goes on and on and on. And it has to come to an end. We can, and now that the world is so small and our weapons are so powerful, there just simply is not acceptable for the mind that doesn't know itself to cause this level of catastrophe in other completely innocent people, women, children, you know, societies that deserve to flourish, all societies, including Russian society, but not at the expense of other societies. But that's going to mean waking up at a planetary level for human beings, which if Ukraine hadn't happened, we'd still have to do because of global warming, because of the fact that we collectively have given the planet a fever. So we now have a big disease on a planetary level. And we have all these other, you know, sort of festering diseases with outright unthinkable levels of violence, but that could actually go to even greater levels of violence today, tomorrow, or next week. And so that's the challenge that humanity is facing. And that's why mindfulness is more relevant now in terms of the medicine of the world than it is actually the medicine of a stress reduction clinic or a pain clinic in one particular hospital.
Practice. Yeah, I see this connected to your extension of the classic definition that you offered in that 2003 paper, first being the awareness that arises from paying attention on purpose in the present and non-judgmentally. So that's the classic practice of mindfulness meditation. But then I like the second part that you added recently. I think it was in a 2021 reprint of something you had done earlier. I'll put in the notes here. And it's, you say, if you need a reason for doing this, we could add in the service of wisdom, self-understanding, and recognizing our intrinsic interconnectedness with others in a world and advance our service of kindness and compassion. So of all, you know, people classically will just in the research world go to that first part. And did you have like a rethinking there of, or getting feedback and saying,
it really has to do with my Zen training, that less is more. And I didn't want to specify that you should meditate for a reason, because meditation is the one thing that we engage in for no reason. We engage in it for its own intrinsic and completely obvious value, that if you're not fully present, then you're not fully alive in that moment. And so I was very reluctant to create a reason to meditate or to be mindful, or an outcome of a, you know, sort of proficient mindfulness practice, because then it's one more thing with a gaining idea that I'm doing this so that I will be a better person, so that I will have a calmer mind or whatever. But as soon as you're attached to an outcome, you're not practicing mindfulness anymore. You're practicing attachment. So with these wisdom traditions, it's very hard to find a way to language them, to articulate them in ways that will actually penetrate our conceptual minds and highly intellectual minds among, you know, professionals, to the point where they realize this is not one more of the same old, same old. This is actually a hidden dimension of reality, which I often speak of as orthogonal to our conventional perspective of reality, and that being orthogonal to it, it can occupy the same space at the same time, but it actually completely transforms our relationship to experience. And experience, even among neuroscientists, that's the most difficult thing to actually understand, is how we get experience, how we get sentience as sentient beings out of, 100 billion neurons in the head. And it's a big mystery, but the most important point is to not get caught in dualisms. And I try to use language in such a way that people who don't actually even understand that dualism is a problem, that the language is such that you wouldn't even notice that, but you'd actually recognize that we're not meditating to become equanimous or to become compassionate or to become a better person, because you can't be a better person because you're already complete and whole as you are. But you could become who you already are. And there are obscurations or blockages, if you will, or impediments to actually being who you are. And that was exactly what the Thoreau quote was pointing at, that you can zone along on autopilot straight into your grave and then realize right before you die that you got the whole karmic assignment wrong, so to speak, because you are attached to an outcome. So non-attachment to outcome is absolutely fundamental to the practice of mindfulness, and how to introduce that into scientific parlance in a way that makes a difference, so that you can study the outcomes of people not being attached to any outcome is really important. And I hope that the scientific community around mindfulness has reached a point where we're understanding that in our labs and in our clinics and in our various studies, because otherwise we'll have people meditating to get somewhere else and they'll miss the only place that they could possibly be, which is here and now. And that's a whole science of its own.
And well, and thank you for conceptualizing, translating, and reminding us of what that antidote might look like. So Dr. Kabat-Zinn, thank you so much for participating in this series that we titled On the Origins of Mindfulness. I personally see your contribution as a gift in my life, helping me find a career orientation with heart. So I thank you for all that you've done. Listeners can find our recordings at goamra.org. That's it for today. Bye now.